Good afternoon. My name is Nora Peel. I'm the Deputy Director of the Boston Book Festival. I'd like to thank you all for being here this afternoon. I'd like to thank our sponsors, especially our presenting partner, WBUR 90.9, Boston's NPR news station. I'd also like to thank our... I'd like to thank our members and our donors at all levels. And if you'd like to find out how you can become a part of the Boston Book Festival, I'd encourage you to visit our website at bostonbookfest.org. Today's final fiction session at the BBF brings together three writers whose work explores the complexity and variability of love, from the romantic kind to the sexy kind to the unrequited kind. Helping us make sense of all of this, the fiction, if not our love lives, is James Wood, book critic for The New Yorker and author most recently of The Fun Stuff. Please join me in welcoming James Wood.
Thank you very much, everyone. First of all, can you hear me? Yeah? I don't promise to be an expert on your love life, and in that respect, I should offer the caveat that The Fun Stuff, the aforementioned book of essays, is not quite as fun as it sounds. More like a collection of reviews, which is pretty unfun, really, in comparison with what we might be discussing today. It's a huge pleasure to be in conversation with Nicholson Baker, André Dubus III, and Jamie Quattro today. Many of you will be familiar with Nicholson Baker's ecstatically inordinate micro-descriptions of everything, from the inside of a dishwasher to our genitalia. And familiar also with fantastic books like Vox, You and I, The Mezzanine, House of Holes. His latest novel, Traveling Sprinkler, I have it right here, is a kind of sequel to his novel, The Anthologist, and gives us another welcome installment of the genial and capacious voice of Paul Chowder, poet, smoker, crank, attitudinizer, ethical citizen. André Dubus is famous, especially in these parts, for his powerful bare-knuckled memoir, Townie, a terrific book, and of course for his rich novel, House of Sand and Fog. His new book, Dirty Love, features three linked novellas, stories of betrayal and adultery and sad cyber sex played out in a town not far from here and in families remarkable for their wounded ordinariness. Jamie Quattro may be less well known to you. Her marvelous book of short stories, I Want to Show You More, appeared earlier this year. It's a first book, a book of stories original in form, language, and content. Though many of them apparently resemble conventional tales of adultery, the context of that adultery, often against a religious tradition of prohibition, and the form it takes, often virtual adultery conducted by email, smartphone, Skype, along with the extreme brevity of much of Quattro's work, combine to make these visceral and moving pieces anything but conventional. I had the pleasure of reviewing this book earlier this year in the New Yorker, and it was a marvelous discovery for me. So I don't think there's any particular form to the discussion. We'll talk for a little while, and then we'll throw it open to the audience. I'm sure you all have your questions, and I don't think, despite the alluring title of the talk today, we don't have to. We don't have to limit ourselves to discussing dirty, endless love, although it is endless. What I might do, first of all, is ask each of you in turn just a question about the writing of your books, because in different ways, you've all been doing new things in these books, departures. So, André, if I might just start with you. Three linked novellas, pretty long, I mean, long short stories, 80, 90 pages, with threaded characters who reappear, sometimes just seen glimpsed from the side. Was that a form that just sort of found itself, or were you pretty sure at the beginning that that's what you wanted to do?
It did find itself, and it found itself through abject failure, which is normal. The two oldest, and there are four in the collection, the two oldest were phoenixes from the ashes of the same novel that failed over 9 years.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write about a certain kind of guy, and what came instead was his father, who was the bartender. And then I spent 2 years on that disaster, and then got the 50 pages out of the 250 pages of what failed.
Right.
And then one of the other ones, Marla, came out of... I spent 5.5 years writing another novel, and then she came out of another two-year effort at the same novel, and there she is. And the other two came organically in the last 3 years, with no design of mine. I wasn't trying to write novellas.
Right. But there was, but you wanted to continue similar stories and the same people.
Well, I would like to sound smarter than I am, but the truth is my editor pointed out that, you know, that these take place in the same town and two people are working in the same bank and three others in the same restaurant. I said, no shit. We had a bet. Who's going to swear first in this friggin' church? I will. So honestly, it was pointed out to me, and I know it sounds... Well, I'm curious how it sounds. The deeper I go into the dream world, and I think that's what writers do when we write fiction, it has connections of its own that can be a surprise to us. And that's, you know, one really good thing that editors can point out.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it worked wonderfully. And like most writers, I like the novella form because of what it enables us to, the sort of pacing... shape, and just the pressure of form is a pleasure in itself. Thinking of the pressure of form, Jamie, this is a book of, I don't know how many stories, 10, 12, something like that.
I don't even know, maybe 15?
Some of them are only a couple of pages long. I can think of two or three that are more like conventional lengths of 10, 15 pages, 4,000 or 5,000 words. The short ones, again, same question, really. That's a form that just tends to find itself as you're writing, or you have a sense that before you start that this is going to be an exercise in limitation rather than expansion.
I would echo a lot of what Andre said. I don't often know what I'm doing when I start, and then the form just kind of finds itself along the way. Those very short pieces... In particular, several of those began as poems.
Uh-huh.
And I love poetry. I think, just shout out, all fiction writers here should be reading poetry. And I read a lot of poetry, and so I thought, maybe I should try writing poetry. And a lot of times, my poetry is just sentences, like, structured into stanzas, and I'm like, these are just sentences. So I can sometimes take them apart. And so a couple of those, that's what I ended up doing. I thought, this isn't a poem. This is a piece of flash fiction. Though those categories are so nebulous.
Yeah.
What is a prose poem and what is a piece of flash fiction? It's difficult. But a lot of feeling my way with all of the stories, the short and the long.
Yeah, and you've done an MFA, am I right in saying?
Yes.
So some of these were things you worked on as a student.
Exactly. Yeah. I went to the Bennington College Writing Seminars, and I graduated in 2009, so very recently, and I hadn't published a single story. And I had a thesis of 6 stories,
right.
And all 6 of them are actually in the collection in very, very different forms. So that was kind of the seed of the collection, and then went home after I graduated and, you know, nose to the grindstone. Just kept working one story to the next. I had no idea someday I'd have a book or really what they would comprise. I just wanted to keep going.
And you'd send those stories out once you'd finished them to see, I mean, for publication
So once I graduated and I felt like they were finished, I did. I kind of took a day and just thought, I'll send each story to 10 journals. And
right.
If you can do the math, imagine all the rejection that engendered. It was a lot of rejection. And I saved all my rejection slips. And it's really helpful, actually, to look back at those and, remember how hard it is. How hard it is. And I think that's where we all need to stay in some sense, in that place of just working one scene to the next.
Yeah, yeah. Hoarding the weasel words of all the rejection letters.
So. The weasel words.
This isn't quite for us. That's, you always get these annoying sort of phrases. You know? Yeah. It doesn't quite work for us, but no doubt elsewhere. Yeah. Right.
You get like a little...
No.
That's a, yeah, that too, yeah.
Or you get like a little tiny, like someone's initials. You're like, oh, yes.
Right.
They really liked it.
Nicholson, this is a sequel. If you don't mind that word, another installment. And it seems experimental to me in many ways, but one is that the risks you're taking with voice, and it's interesting in the latest novel in a couple of places, the narrator says, there's all these things I'd like to fit into to a poem, you know, over-salting of streets, abolition of the CIA, new flavors of toothpaste, but you can't. You have to stop. It won't make a good poem. Obviously, I'm lost again. In general, it's true of your prose work, but in these two novels in particular, narrated by Paul Chowder, you're able to put everything in. Or seemingly. So I suppose the question that I had for you is, every writer's task is to know, you know, where to stop. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a, how do you... there's always the... We all know the risk when writing in first person that you won't stop, or one won't stop. And yet, these are fairly brief novels, too, and yet they're very capacious. So how did you... You aware of managing that tension?
I've always had trouble knowing when to stop. Actually, my first book was about a guy riding an escalator, and he was trying to write about the things that he actually loved, the things around him that he actually had things to say about. And yeah. I remember thinking, you know, that it was kind of adventurous to just write, "I love when," and then just say it. And then it turned out there was more to say and too much to say, and the paragraph was obviously bloated and wrong.
Right.
And so what I did then was move half the paragraph to a footnote, and that was exciting and stimulating and helped a lot. And helped the reader, I think, because some readers don't want to jump down. Yeah. So I've always been struggling with this problem of how to limit myself. And what I found in writing the first book that's sort of in this tone, called The Anthologist, with Paul Chowder as a hero, is that what helped me a lot was sitting and in a white plastic chair and arranging a video camera in front of me and saying to myself, you are going to tell it, you're going to explain it to some pretend audience.
Yeah.
And that does an amazing... It forces you to put one word after another in a different way. So I did that, recorded myself and transcribed and ended up with an enormous bunch of pages that then had to be kind of fiddled with and rearranged using random number patterns and things. Yeah. But in the end, I had something that was nice and short, which is the way I like it, you know.
Yeah.
A novel. It's an amazing thing when something huge comes down. So this one, I thought, well, I did the video camera. What can I do now? Mm. And I discovered my car. Sitting in the car, trying to, again, to say, what is it about life that we really love and what we really want to think about? And you're in a very quiet place. The most comfortable chair I know is the driver's seat of the car. The car is parked, obviously. And I found that talking and typing in this solitude and trying and sort of missing everything else. You're parked, maybe you're looking out at an ocean, there's people reading the newspaper, looking at the ocean. You have a little bit of companionship, but you're isolated. That feeling of being isolated reminds you of all the things that you wish you were nearby.
Yeah. We're going to come to technology in a minute because I think it's an interesting aspect of the way in which sex and love is being played out in all these books, not just sex and love, but other things too. But technology makes me think. I mean, you couldn't see yourself using voice recognition software like Richard Powers, could you? You couldn't. You wouldn't get actually to that point where you were
when I
dictating a book.
I've tried. The problem is you have to talk like this and say comma, and it's not, the words then are not no longer spoken. All the delightfulness of misdirection, mm-hmm. those moments where you hesitate and you trail off and go in a different direction, all yeah. those things are lost because you're speaking for a piece of software. So it seems to work better to just say it.
I'm dying to ask a question. Yeah. So did you watch the video and while typing what you actually said on the video?
It got a little hard. Well, in The Anthologist, the man is a poet, and I thought, okay, I have a kind of whitening beard, and I grew it out to be this enormous beard, and I just was so sick of my beard, I couldn't look at it. So I stripped out the audio and transcribed it as a purely heard phenomenon. It was much better that way.
But you must have rewritten extensively, because spoken speech recorded as transcripts.
Right, it's never.
It's usually very unreadable. But I'm not saying you were unreadable.
They're unreadable.
I mean, it's a famous grad school thing where graduate yeah. students will sit around and they'll tape a 3-hour conversation, type it up, the most brilliant conversations, until you read it.
Yeah.
So, what did you run into?
But it's useful to study how I made a living as a temp typist here in Boston. I worked in all these buildings around here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I had to do for a while for this guy who worked for The Atlantic was type. He would interview famous movie stars, and then he hired me to type the raw transcript. It was just so fascinating. And then, of course, he cleaned it up, and it became a beautiful little piece that was short and pithy. But I saw how all those little moments where the person was hesitating. So I've always liked the idea of learning from the way people actually describe things, slowing down and thinking about where it is that we hesitate to say the next thing. When it is that somebody says, no, wasn't it another way? And you then have a little more to say.
Yeah.
So that the rhythm of talk has always been really interesting to me.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Let's just talk a little bit about prohibition. Here we are in this church, and we're just on the verge of really, really being blasphemous and swearing, and we're going to do it. It's going to happen. So
not for me.
No, I'm but Jamie.
Oh gosh, I'm the blasphemous swearing.
You're the blasphemer. You're the real blasphemer. These wonderful stories in the collection, particularly the ones that deal with sort of virtual adultery. People are just managing long distance affairs that almost don't rise to the occasion or to the word of an affair, conducted often through technology, iPhone or whatever. Particularly interesting to me because they're often they were played against a background of they were seem to be written by and about people who had a biblical literacy in Imperfections, for instance, wonderful 3-page story or something. The woman married woman is about to kiss the married man. It would be, a moment of a real step. And she hears Joseph and Potiphar's wife flee. She hears the biblical prohibition, does it anyway. And then he kisses her eye, I think, is that right?
And forehead, but yeah.
And she feels his kiss to be like a seal, like a wax seal that has stung, the wax dripping down. It immediately made me think of the Song of Solomon, set me as a seal upon your heart. I think that's fairly unusual nowadays to there's plenty of adultery around, but generally generally the difficulty for contemporary writers is most of the prohibition is gone, and certainly most of the religious prohibition is gone. So I just wanted to ask you really about that as a both as background, the biblical stuff, and how you were mobilizing it in your fiction.
Right. Well, a couple things. I think that when you, and I did grow up in a church, and when you grow up in that environment, as you did, where there is, on the one hand, all of this stricture against sort of anything to do with the body, So, you know, no sex, no drinking, you know, in particular denominations, even no dancing.
Yeah.
Though my parents weren't quite that strict. So you have all these strictures on the one hand, and yet you're reading the Bible, and when you actually do read it, it's full of sex.
Yeah.
And it's full of sexual metaphor and sexual imagery to describe the way that God feels about his people. You have language like the bride and the bridegroom.
Yeah.
You have books like Hosea, which I'm actually rereading as research right now, where, you know, Hosea is commanded to marry a prostitute in part to image the way God loves this unfaithful people, Israel.
Yes.
So it's this kind of strange, I guess, cognitive dissonance that you grow up with, thinking, well, if all of this is bad, and yet, you know, the Bible's full of all of this, how do those two things come together? So I think that, and again, I didn't start out to think, well, I'm interested in this question, and so I'm going to write fiction that addresses this question. You just write out of your obsessions or your preoccupations or your, I guess, wounds in some ways. And mm-hmm. so you just, I guess, as I started writing about infidelity, I had to write through the lens of both the strictures and the places where those two things came together.
Yeah.
And I do think there is something highly, you know, eroticism, and just the word ecstasy, you know, it's used in both sexual and spiritual contexts. Ecstasis, out, ek out, and stasis to stand. So this mm-hmm. experience of standing outside the body is what we think of as ecstasy, and yet everything we know to give an ecstatic experience is located within the body.
Yeah.
So, you know, sex, exercise, breathing exercises, psychotropic drugs. So there's some coming together there of the sexual and the sacred, and I wanted to explore that. I think it's a worthy of exploration, particularly within a Christian context, which, you, like you say, you don't see a lot.
No, I agree. I mean, it's the thing I really like about these stories is that it isn't just one half. You actually mobilize both the sense of prohibition, blasphemy, sin, you know, the shame of all of those ancient prohibitions, and as you say, the other side. I mean, the apple is an apple of desire, as well as the fruit of fallenness. Song of Solomon, as everyone knows, is an incredibly lusty and beautifully sensual poem, long poem. Nicholson, in House of Holes, there's a great deal of license, and it's fantastically described. It's a sort of orgy of pleasure. But there's also a sort of undercurrent of, I wouldn't say punishment, but there are certain ways of doing things, and there are certain ways of not doing things. And in that book, as I recall, there are certain prohibitions if you err. Yeah, if you turn the wrong corner and press the wrong thing, as it were.
Yes, I suppose that it has to do with that need to have there be consequences and thwartedness and things that you have to surmount. House of Holes is really a pleasure resort where you can take off your clothes and do whatever you want. You could have dropped through a hole in... I was thinking of Ringo Starr in The Yellow Submarine, where he goes to the... You know, he just sort of drops into a hole, and then everything is different, and everybody seems cheerful, and there's
right.
no
yeah.
disease and pregnancy. And but on the other hand, if you displease the woman who's in charge, she might force
right.
you to swap genitalia with someone else, and that turns out to be fun too. So I thought it was. I was hoping it was. Although there was, as you say, there's some consequences. You know, if you overdo in that direction. Something else good might happen to you
right.
over here. But and there are rules. Even so, I wanted it to be a fundamentally cheerful book because I'm distressed
yes.
sometimes by, you know, there's such a dungeon-y quality sometimes about, you know, or at least a negative quality about literary sex scenes. I think that's why I wrote Vox, actually, was I thought, you know, that there are these literary novels and they have these things, these little moments of altered state where you describe a sex scene and then you're out... You're, you know, sponging off the counters and driving your car, and then you're in a sex scene and the vocabulary changes. And actually, why not just expand the whole book to be a phone sex scene? And then the sponging of the counter can, you know,
yeah.
gains an illicit quality because you're not talking about sex. So the energies sort of flip, the polarities flip.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, it's a wonderfully utopian quality in your work. And then, of course, it's a, as we know, it's a hideous historical, but I also think a telling irony that very sort of free and utopian book like Vox then gets, I mean, in the famous, you know, Clintonian moment is an element of an episode of sex that couldn't be more marked by prohibition, danger, risk, shame, you know, errancy, all the things that were far from the utopian, alas.
What James Wood is referring to is this wonderful moment in my life where Monica Lewinsky gave my book, her thumbed copy of my book, Vox, to the president and said, here, read this. And then somebody called me up, a reporter called me up saying, what do you think about this? Well, I thought, my God, it's so great that a human being gave my book to another human being as part of some sort of seduction. It's great. Of course, we don't want Clinton to, you know, his privacy's invaded, her privacy's invaded. He's the president, he's married, there's all sorts of other things going on. But I was just thinking how thrilled I was to be part of a national scandal.
That's great.
And it's nice to reclaim it in that way. I think, you know, in Philip Roth and The Human Stain did a similar thing where he has a very long, as I remember, a very long multi-page running footnote, which essentially sort of libidinously retells the entire Lewinsky story. I'm probably misremembering it. It's amazing how much one forgets of the fiction one reads. But I think that's, I think that's the case. It's a sort of deliberate assertion of, on Roth's part, that it will be somehow reclaimed from the hideous politics and so on. Andre, the novellas in Dirty Love. Well, let's actually deal, because they're actually quite different. The last one, the title one, is I think very different from say the first one. I suppose the first one, in some ways, is more conventional in the sense that there is. There's a family, there's infidelity on the part of the wife, and at the same time, and this is what's so beautifully structured, a seemingly unimportant infidelity on the part of the husband too. Mm. Not really as payback, but just as a
fallout.
Exactly. I just wanted to ask you really about the constant theme in the book is a lovely one is not judging, right? Mm. Is precisely the opposite of prohibition. I mean, there is plenty to go around. There's plenty of shame and anger, and everyone's aware that they shouldn't be doing the things they're doing. And yet, what people want in your book is not to be judged, mm-hmm. even as they're sinning, which I think is exactly what great fiction does too.
Well, you know, I'm not, sin is not part of my vocabulary. I'm not a fan of organized religion, and I do want to swear in this church. And I mean, no disrespect to anyone who's faithful. My wife's a very devout Christian, and I respect that about her. Mm. I like to play play. I find myself writing about people who are more like me in that they have no religious faith. Mm-hmm. No theological beliefs of any kind. And that kind of leaves you, and I'm not saying it's a good thing, kind of leaves you groping in the dark, trying to make up your rules as you go. And we tend to screw up, you know. I like your observation that his infidelity is sort of, it's a fallout from hers.
Right.
One of the things, you know, look, I never know what I'm doing, echoing what Jamie said, and to me that's the joy of writing fiction is, you know, there's a wonderful line from Tim O'Brien. He said that fiction writers tend to be the kind of people who want to enter the mystery of things. Mm-hmm. I began with a tableau that comes from life. A friend of mine was living in a situation where his wife was cheating on him. He knew about it. He was hoping to get her back. She was living in the house that they raised their kids in. They're in the mid-50s. He had built an in-law apartment for his mother attached to the house, and he was sleeping on his mother's couch, and the only people living in that house were those three people. for months. Right. And I thought, well, I have to step into that situation. And what came was really a man falling apart, but what was gratifying to discover is he wasn't just the victim he begins thinking he is.
Right.
He has a real hand in his wife's estrangement. And
absolutely. The turn
don't
is wonderfully
we all?
Done. Yeah. No, the turn is wonderfully done, and the way you press further and further on the controlling side of him that is exactly what his wife has found difficult over so many years is beautifully done. In the Thank title you. Story, Dirty Love, that gives us a bit of our title today, that's an awfully sad piece of work, I thought.
Is it?
I think so. I mean, there's some hope at the end, but
there's a little hope.
But sad, I think, just partly of the picture, one picture it gives today of I guess she's about 18, right? Of an 18-year-old girl, and I think sadder in a way than what she gets up to in her room on a computer, you know, Skyping or
chat
chatting, yeah, or chat roulette with you know any number of men, is the backstory of the sort of 3 or 4 years before that, the way essentially she came up through the sexual ranks, oral sex, the obsession with oral sex, the particular power dynamics. There's a very fine thing you write. I just want to get it correct. Let's see.
It's nice when a reviewer says that.
Yeah, well,
that's a good.
Well, get it right. Yes, it is rather important, isn't it?
Getting it.
It's where you talk about Devon realizing that she has a power over boys because she can pleasure them, and in so doing pacifies them. It's an interesting that she actually makes them so. Devon's early experiences with giving guys blowjobs changed him from being restless and grasping and distracted to this quiet, satisfied boy with his arm around her. That seems truthful to me, but awfully sad too.
I try not to inject any philosophical or political belief into any fiction, but it sure does. There's a wonderful essay from Flannery O'Connor, The Nature and Name of Fiction. She says a writer's beliefs are not what she sees, but the light by which she sees, which is probably why yours is rising up and the way it does. You know, but I am haunted by the hypersexualization of young women now.
Yeah.
We've always objectified girls and women, but I do think the gadgets have made it worse.
Right.
And you know, I'm sounding like an old man now, but in the 70s, we all had loveless sex, but it didn't feel like the contact sport it is now for teenagers, and
right.
Especially girls giving boys blowjobs. Are you kidding me? This isn't sex. Right. So, I mean, this is their belief, but we know it is. We know it's intimate. We know it does something to the soul, whether you've shut off your heart or not, and that part does scare me. Devon, the main character, though, I think is strong enough to survive at all, but one of the things she's doing, and there's been a pornographic film made of her giving a guy a blowjob and put online, and she's fleeing that, and she's staying with her 81-year-old great-uncle, and the only man who's ever really loved her totally that she's felt, and one of the ways she's trying to get her power back, which surprised me, I didn't know why she was doing it, but nightly she goes on Chat Roulette, that weird website where you hit a button and you're in front of a stranger anywhere in the world. And a lot of the strangers are young men masturbating, frankly. And and I realized she's just trying to get her power back. She's, you know, you're going to look at me, you're not going to get shit from me.
Right. She doesn't respond.
Yeah.
She makes them talk. She makes them do stuff.
Yeah,
she gives nothing back.
Nothing.
Yeah.
I'm in charge.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. Yeah.
He's like the worst kind of psychoanalyst.
Yeah.
Canadian analyst.
Yeah, yeah. When are you going to talk for $150 an hour? So I've read.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about technology, either technology as it might have changed sexual relations or the way you all three of you incorporate a lot of new technology. It's really striking in your fiction, just without any strain at all. It's all there, and that is how people are communicating with each other and often with themselves. Jamie?
Yeah. I think living in the digital age has really raised a question that, you know, what constitutes infidelity now? Like you say, it used to be that you'd have to drive to a hotel and or wherever, arrange a meeting, and there would be this physical connection. And I think that the digital age has in some ways removed that need, and so it makes it seem okay in some ways, especially to the younger generation. Mm. And you know, it's so hard to keep up with. I didn't know about this roulette thing.
No, I didn't know.
Thank God. We both have teenagers, so.
That's how I found
out. Yeah. I found out about recently Snapchat, which is probably totally like, you know, 2011 or whatever. But it's this thing where, you know, you can take a picture and send it and it's wiped after 7 seconds. And you just know why that was invented.
Right.
You know, my daughter says, we just send funny.
So it's wiped after it
7 seconds.
Exist.
So you, right, okay. you can take a picture and send it, and then 7 seconds it's gone. Yeah. Okay. Let's get very graphic here in front of Jesus.
He doesn't care. Jesus understands.
He's goading Jesus on.
I would agree with you, actually. I think that that's an important thing right now to discuss, and not that I was intentionally saying I'm going to write this and then bring this into the public discussion, and I'm sure that Nicholson and Andre weren't either, but it's just where we are. It's just where we're living. And
of course.
I also think that eroticism resides in the almost and the build-up. I think that as soon as consummation happens, it fulfills that desire, but it also begins to kill it. And so with digital technology, you can prolong that eroticism, that build-up for an indefinite amount of time when you're not actually meeting.
You mean with your husband when you're texting?
Right, right. Yeah. When we're sending each other the naked selfies. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And you've certainly
built up and built.
And you've used that.
Yes, exactly.
Very well in your fiction as a way of, making these. I mean, it's like sort of Brief Encounter, but digitalized. It's like you know, the old film brought up to date. Yeah. Because of there's a phenomenal amount of technology going on in these Paul Chowder novels, YouTube and iTunes and anything. It's all there.
Because I was trying to capture the texture of life, and I thought, and I got, because I just finished an extremely graphic, explicit sex novel, the sort of the sex part. I mean, I think the great thing about novels is that you can be in a certain mood and you can go in that direction and then be done. And maybe you can, so Traveling Sprinkler is really about, it's about a traveling sprinkler. I mean, it's about an old piece of technology. It's a cast iron tractor that moves through your garden and sprinkles your tomatoes. I mean, that's technology too. But he does look at protest songs on the internet and everything. His love conundrum is that longtime life companion, this woman who has this quality of loving kindness that he really needs and wants, has become a producer at a public radio station in Concord, and she has met this man with a really low, good Oliver Sacks kind of voice, a radio voice, and she's gone away from him. So really, it's although we live in this time where you can learn about things through all sorts of interesting electronic channels, it's still jealousy, it's still wanting someone back, it's still wanting to be loved, it's still finding a way to be interesting, still interesting and exciting to somebody, you know? And he's trying to think, wow, how can I win her back? Well, maybe I can write a song. And there again, technology comes in because you can, you know, buy a fancy piece of software called Logic Pro, maybe a company some have heard of, Apple. And you can layer sounds and do things with a piano, let's say, that you couldn't actually do yourself. And that, so writing a song then becomes a kind of interestingly technologically sophisticated act, but it's still a song. You know, it's still somebody trying to make his voice into something that seduces somebody. So really the age-old yearnings are all there. There's no change. It's just that, you know, we have a lot more ways to get to people.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think these age-old yearnings are being bastardized by the whole goddamn thing.
Well,
sorry, I'm tilting my technology-hating hand here.
Not in your fiction. I mean,
I'm trying to, especially in Dirty Love, I was trying to be this 18-year-old woman who's totally addicted to it, and it's part of her life, and she's got that eye gadget sewn to her hand, like my 18-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
But I don't know, Nick. I mean, I think that yearning You know, look, I see this abomination, this new advertisement on television about where they have people in gorgeous canyons and on mountaintops staring at their screen and, yeah. and you know, sitting in a field and staring at their screen, and they actually advertising this as a good thing. I'm connected with everything. I said, what is wrong with you people? You're in a fucking meadow. Turn it off.
He did it. He did it.
You know, I did it. Sorry. I'm sorry.
You need to go stand up there and like, yeah, all right. And,
but I don't know. I think the yearnings are being,
right.
I think our genuine, as I agree with you, yearning for human connection is never going to go away. But there's something about these gadgets that cast us in a trance and are making us rude and stupid, in my opinion, that is increasing our yearning in a way that you can never get enough Doritos. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Amen. Amen.
I mean, do you disagree? I mean, you seem more friendly to it, which is fine. I don't know.
I think it's great that you think, oh, I miss my son, you know, and then you think, well, you can type out, how's it going? And you're not actually interrupting his life, but let's take the world of pornography, because obviously that's part of what you're talking about.
Yeah. Yep.
One of the things that's happened is that because people film themselves, you get actually more human, more strangeness, more complexity of the way people actually talk and think and are revealing their true exhibitionistic side. And so I've learned a great deal from pornography, actually. I mean, as a novelist, I've learned a huge amount from it. I'm very grateful to it.
That.
There is a lot of horrible stuff, but there's a lot of horrible stuff. You know, there was a ton of horrible stuff on the newsstand when we were kids, and you just have to develop filtration systems that are a little more sophisticated and not worry so much. And sometimes, you know, God, I mean, if I climbed a mountain, and I was looking out, you know, after a while, it's windy, it's kind of cold, and you think, I'm going to go home. Let me check my, let's see if I got Wi-Fi.
But I was at a dinner 2 nights ago in New York, and this man was describing Alice Munro, when the Nobel Prize, describing the picture of her in her kitchen in London, Ontario. Mm-hmm. He was describing her, and the younger man next to me reached in and brought up on the screen the photograph that this man was describing. And it was almost, it was a strange little abomination. Because I was really enjoying his word choice,
right.
his wrestling with describing it. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at it.
Yeah.
To me, it was lovemaking versus porn. I'd rather, there was more romance in what he was saying. But given that I'm full of shit because I love Skyping my son in Ohio. And I, it's not so simple, is it?
So as the middle ground between these two,
I
agree. I think what Andre's saying, there's so many ways that technology is sort of denigrating our authentic experience of living. But I also agree with you that it's so nice to be able to text my children right now when I'm in Boston and they're all at home.
Mm-hmm.
So there's good uses and bad uses. My concern, though, is with the pornography, having teenage sons, that you have a filtration system in place after however many years of developing it. But, you know, I wish it was the days when all they would have to do is walk into a store, you know, or the shame that maybe they would feel, or maybe they'd think twice if they had to go up to a person and say, I need to buy this, versus, you know, on their phone, boom, there it is.
Right.
I just think the ease of access has become a danger, maybe, for addictive, particularly kids who have addictive tendencies.
Well, maybe that's true. Yeah. I remember the first time I bought a dirty magazine. I thought to myself, well, what, should I steal it? That's wrong. You know, I'm embarrassed.
I stole mine.
Should I, you know, tear out a page? And I thought, you know, I think I was 16 or 15 or something. And I thought, you know, I have some money in my wallet, and it's actually a financial transaction. It's a price on the cover. And so I just lifted it and brought it up to the, you know, shakingly, and bought it. And it was a very exciting, crazy.
And the guy sold it to you.
The woman sold it to me.
What kind of magazine was it?
It was the first issue. Actually, it's a historic thing. It was the first issue of We Magazine, which is edited by a newspaper columnist, John. You remember We?
Yeah.
John Carroll, and it was a, you know, it was a quality publication.
very good production values. Yeah.
Yes. I have a later sold to a, you know.
I have a very vivid memory of my
father finding a magazine, which I'd hidden it so carefully, but he did find it. And then in an incredibly headmasterly way, and I have to say profoundly unconvincing too, he said, "I am now confiscating this."
I thought, "I bet you are." Yeah.
From my room. Yeah. I know, can I just say one quick thing about what Jamie said? I think is profoundly important. Because you're right. Grown men do have a filter. Our brains are developed. I do have sincere concerns, and probably like a lot of people, and maybe there are a lot of teachers in this room, 11 to 19, I would have, what I would have done to get my hands on some hardcore porn. Mm. I would have stayed in my room all day. I mean, my God, you have an erection all day.
Right.
And I do think it's very troubling that they can just hit a button. I mean, I used to go to a part of town where I grew up where you get mugged trying to steal that swank for me, which is all well and good, but I do worry about these kids. They hit a button, and they can be looking at things that they're not ready to look at, I don't think, in any way. And I do worry that it further, as their brains are developing, their sense about girls and women, I think it is leading them to objectify women in a harsher way. I think it's doing a real number. And I think it's what's leading to women, young women like Devin, thinking a blowjob isn't sex.
Right.
I think it's really dangerous.
Right. And girls objectifying men and feeling terrible about them. So, I mean, body image is a huge thing. I have two girls, two boys, and body image is a big thing. And, you know, that industry...
Right, far more self-conscious generally.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when we were growing up, it was actually a freedom of being young that you didn't give a shit about your body, right? I mean, that essentially. That's not true. You were pumping iron like a crazy guy.
I was small and scared.
But I mean, essentially, at 20, you know, you're a effortlessly functioning metabolism that doesn't need to take any exercise, doesn't need much sleep, and doesn't need to worry about what it looks like. That's the freedom of being, right? You're not worrying about what your abs look like and so on. But yeah, the self-consciousness is, that's absolutely true. On that elevated note, we can now turn it over to the audience, happy to take questions.
Hello, my name is Robert Moulton, and I am currently I'm going to be terminated Monday. I am a teacher at Drake at Senior High School, and I shared a story of mine that had some sex in it, had some profanity in it, and the students were okay with it, the administration was not. It isn't a light matter. Your books, Andre, I'd love to teach House of Sand and Fog, but I can't. Would you like to see your latest release taught in high school?
Hell yes.
Me too. And I would love to teach it, but I can't. And
you got terminated for reading a story that had was it graphic sex? What was it? Were you tasteful?
It's very tasteful. I think, as a matter of fact, I don't think James read it, but I submitted it to the New Yorker. I got a rejection letter too. I love it. I show it to my students. It's very tasteful. In the line of Bolaño and David Foster Wallace, I think my brother's there. It's very tasteful. I have it with me. It's a great story.
James.
I'm going to slip it to James. It was a story that it did have in the students. I got a standing ovation. It was one of the greatest moments of my teaching career. But there was a 55-year-old aide in the room. And she told the principal, and I'm being terminated because of this. Now, this ties into, because what you guys are talking about, this is great, but where do we go? Where do we get to the education? I have children too. Where do we get to the point where we can bring them to have a filter like we do? I mean, if it's there. It's not like anything that I did in the story is not something that they've never seen before. They have, but we're not allowed to talk about it. In the high school, I disagree. I think that how would you teach your book to high school students, and how would you get administration and people involved that we can come to a point where we can move on and deal with this very sensitive and important, very important. I mean, sex is everywhere. Without.
Well, thank you.
Censorship.
For the question.
Censorship. I mean, this is what it is. Yeah.
We can generally talk about self-censorship. I mean, that's to say, I presume that none of you have felt that. I mean, you felt that fiction is analogous to freedom, is freedom, and that anything should be written and said on the page. Yes, or mm-hmm.
You know, Robert, I want to quote Senator Anyuwe, I can't pronounce his name, the nice Hawaiian senator who passed away about 5 years ago, World War II veteran. He wrote a really smart essay about pornography. He said the reason pornography is wrong, he said, I don't have any moral problem with pornography, and he said the reason it's misleading is it never captures what the act is. Mm. It just films it. So you don't know if it's an act of aggression, an act of love, an act of surrender, an act of betrayal, an act of trust. And that's where literature comes in, man. I mean, that's where fiction comes in, because we have to go inside the one or two people who are engaged in the act to find out what it is on a spiritual, emotional, you know, more symphonically human level. And you know, look, I think we do children a disservice to let them hit donkey porn and not share fiction with them that deals with it in a serious way.
Right.
The only thing I would say is I think juniors and seniors and up. I wouldn't be sharing real sexy stuff with sophomores and freshmen just on a developmental level, but that's just my opinion. Could be wrong.
Go ahead.
I had to go on a reading tour when Vox came out, which was, you know, I had books that were utterly without any sex at all. I think there was no sex practically in my first three books, and then I wrote this one that was very explicit, and they said, you're going to go on a tour and read from your book, and I said, no. And because I just thought, I don't want to stand up in front of nice people and be reading this and just be, and it, you know, kind of, no. Because novels are private, nice, quiet places you go, and you can observe their rules if you are in the mood to observe them. In public places, we observe other proprieties, and I believe strongly in that. And that, we, you know, in people's living rooms, we don't launch off, unless we want to kind of jostle everyone, in an extended description of some extremely intimate act. We just don't do it. We know that it's wrong to do it. We're evolved to know that. And though there are all kinds of contextual decisions we're making, and when I'm writing a novel that's, you know, like House of Holes, that's kind of totally out there and over the top, that's the rule, those are the set of rules. But with The Traveling Sprinkler, I'm trying to write a love story. It's actually, I'm trying to write a love story that involves a hysterectomy, you know, and a traveling sprinkler. You know, so, I mean, I'm...
But you're
I'm,
okay with seniors or juniors in high school having maybe an explicit story read.
I do, but, you know, I don't feel that in any way that it's a bad thing for my books to be, some of my books to be held back from people or that they have to go to the public library to read them. It's not like they're being censored in any large sense, so I never... I certainly don't want people to be fired for talking about beautiful fiction that has, you know, the random body part mentioned or something. That's wrong. But I think we all follow rules of what feels right in given situations. Even as you're writing a novel, you're thinking, is this too far in this paragraph?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Amy?
This hits really close to home. I was just invited to speak at my son's school, juniors and seniors, and the teacher asked me to read one of my stories. And of course, I was very selective, not because I was afraid of what, you know, censorship, but because of my son.
Yeah.
And that's really embarrassing to have your mom come and read, you know, anything with any even tincture of sexual theme in it. But
his friends would like you.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. As I looked around the room, though, I thought, you know, I know most of these kids. I've watched them go through school together, and there are some who could have handled it fine, and there are some who I know it would have shocked their pants off. And so I think that perhaps in high schools, that's what you're dealing with, is that there's such different levels of development. You can't assume, you know, anything, and they're still minors. I think if it's not gratuitous in any way, but there's a point to it. You know, there's a universal human truth behind it, or we're learning something about a character that's being revealed, and the teacher can articulate that, then I don't think anything, you know, should be off limits, particularly for, you know, progressive thinking, you know, seniors in particular, juniors and seniors.
Good luck, Robert.
Yeah.
wanted to know whether your own children have read your work, and at what point, at what age they may have they looked for it, have you offered it to, you know, what's the relationship there in terms of things you may not want them to read? Because when you're writing and you do have children, etc., you know, get my point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My oldest son, who's 20, began reading my work when he was 18. He began with my cheerful little novel, House of Sand and Fog. And then he read my memoir, which was really kind of brutal because, well, he came up to me and said, "So, Dad, would you want me to do all those things?" "No, honey, say do as I say, not as I did. How's that?" And he's read more of my books, and my youngest son, who's 16, Elias, has read two of my novels this summer. And my daughter hasn't read anything, and she's 18, and that's just fine with me. But she's going to. Actually, quick follow-up. This art thing, I love what Tolstoy said. Art is transferring feeling from one heart to another. I love that. And there's only one thing only, brothers and sisters, that'll do that, and that's truth. Illuminated truth in some way. And I think it's good for us all. And so, you know, the part of me that gets squeamish about, you know, my kids seeing the secret parts of me, or not the secret parts, but the parts of me I don't show them out of boundaries and appropriate behavior around mm-hmm. kids, they're young adults now. And so they're right. entitled to their own experience with whatever. If I have been able to capture any truths, that's their business now. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My youngest son is in seventh grade. He hasn't read anything. The next daughter above him is 14. She's, I gave her a copy of the book and marked the stories that I thought she would, that I thought she would like.
So she better read the other one.
And she did. She's so sweet. She's, you know, I'm reading Jane Eyre aloud to her right now. And, you know, that's kind of her literary taste, Pride and Prejudice. So, yeah, she's not reading certain ones. The older two, I said, have at it. And neither one of them really was interested. They're 16 and 17. Although I will tell you, James, that when your review came out, I was in New York and my daughter texted me and said, "Mom, the AP English classes are reading one of your stories in the New Yorker review."
That's great.
Well, I understand if that makes you uncomfortable, but, you know, I hope you're pleased or whatever. She said, "I'm okay with it." Which, you know, for a 17-year-old, that's like, awesome. I'm okay with it.
That's right. My children are very helpful in reading. I have a son, Elias, who's 19,
cool.
and a daughter who's 26, and they always help me with my nonfiction, help me cut, help me say things better. My wife does too. But the fiction, because they both, I think, harbor aspirations to write themselves, they've sort of protected themselves from, not because it's shocking, but because you know, you're coming from somebody who I have a particular voice, and they would like to find their own way. Maybe they're going to come up with a metaphor that's somewhat similar to mine. They don't want their metaphor to be turned into a puff of smoke because I did something similar on page 26 of six books ago or so. So I think they're more protecting themselves from my fiction, not from. And actually, my son did read some of House of Holes. He said, "Boy, this is kind of funny." And
what did he say?
He said this is kind of funny. And then I said, "You know, yeah, it's kind of an innocent book." And he said, "No, Dad, it's pretty intense. You know,
and there's something wrong with you, Dad."
He's all right with it. I mean, honestly, I think on the whole, I just have to say, in defense of, you know, things like YouTube and technology and everything, but on the whole, although we see things sometimes, images that we will never forget and wish we hadn't seen, that on the whole, there are so many things that I am grateful to have seen. And I put in my book an actual, you know, this guy, Stephen Fearing, who's a Canadian songwriter, mm-hmm. he sings a song that is beautifully, he sings it beautifully, it's not his song, in a Paris hotel lobby. So I thought, I want people to see that thing on YouTube. So I just typed out the entire URL in the book and said, "What the hell? There it is." You know, because it's part of what you want to do with a novel is say, the world is wide open. There's all this beautiful stuff, mm-hmm. you know. Here's something to follow up on. So I think on balance, all these new ways of discovering things, listening to things, hearing sounds, seeing sights you've never seen. Not just, you know, people falling off of low buildings into dumpsters, but, you know, not that that isn't really funny. I mean, there's nothing wrong with
backflips into their jeans.
Funny. Yeah. Yeah. Funny, sometimes things are funny. Sometimes things are just plain pornographically arousing. And that's good, too. So, you know.
Just 2 seconds. I have no problem with the content. No, let it do what it's doing. I have a problem. I was in a hotel a few months ago in L.A. I looked out the window, and I counted 27 people walking by, 24 of whom, on a beautiful sunny day in Los Angeles, were staring at screens in their hands. And it just made me sad. To me, it's our addictive get on the goddamn machine thing that's scaring me. It's not the, and it's lonely. It makes me lonesome. I'm lonesome over here. I've never texted. I'm never gonna text. The bad thing is my kids only communicate with their mother. Hey, hello. I love you. These things you can call on these too, you know.
I think we certainly need a new code of manners. I mean, the dinner parties where you realize there's a strange blue glow coming from someone's crotch have to be ended. You know, that's I think there's time for one final question. That's over there at the back, yeah.
I have a question for Andre specifically, but hopefully all three of you can talk about it. You were talking about a little bit about your religious beliefs, and I was wondering what it was like when you're writing House of Sand and Fog to get into the head of a character who is not only deeply religious, but comes from a place where religion is mandatory, where that is the basis of life. And I was wondering if that, you know, how you got into the character's head, and also if, you know, how that changed maybe your view of religion at all.
Well, thank you, man. The character in House, Sand, and Fog is a retired Iranian colonel. He's actually not a practicing Muslim. He's not very religious. But in my novel, The Garden of Last Days, one of the main characters is a composite of one of the 9/11 Saudi Arabian hijackers, and he's deeply monotheistic to a genocidal, crazy degree. Look, I found it a real challenge to become someone for whom the one and only God was everything. And then it wasn't a challenge. You know, the thing that I love about writing, character-driven fiction, and what I love about reading is, again, that descent into the other. There was a wonderful, gorgeous passage from Eudora Welty's collected story. She has that wonderful preface where she says, "I'm ruining it." It's beautifully written, but she says that the act she holds most high artistically is trying to enter the private skin of another. And I think black, white, male, female, she said. And I think that what's so wonderful about us human beings is the deeper you go into each of us, there is no other. You know, there is a believer in me. There's a fascist in me. There's a whatever. We are all multitudes. That's no original thought. It actually was fairly, after I cast myself in this guy's spell, I was a believer, and I'm going to die for my Allah, and I'm going to take people with me, and I believed it totally, and then I took a long shower after that little ride.
Jamie, you have a Christian background. Are you a practicing mm-hmm. Christian?
Yeah. I am, so yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the hard things is that when you kind of look around at the literature of the last, maybe since the great mid-century Catholics, so Updike and O'Connor yeah. and Thomas Merton and that kind of group, mm-hmm. There hasn't been a real representation, in particular of Christianity or evangelical Christianity, that isn't a caricature or that, you know, doesn't make fun of it in some way.
Right.
And, you know, I read these things and I think, this isn't what I know, this isn't the people I know. But I think on the flip side, the great damage that organized religion has done is they're so quick to give answers, they've forgotten how to ask questions. And so I do think a deep engagement with anything religious involves a lot of asking questions, a lot of wrestling. And so I hope that I come to my faith and that I come to the page with just a lot of very profound questions and very no answers. And I think if I can stay in that place of asking questions and wrestling, Flannery O'Connor said about the South, she said the image of the South is so profound in us that it is as if we must wrestle with it, like the Jacob wrestled with the angel, and we must wrestle with it until we extract a blessing. And so that's how I feel my approach to religion is that I'm wrestling with it and asking questions. But no, I haven't thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and it's still in there.
Because there's a lot of Quakerism in the Chowder novels.
Yes, there is. There are two or three extended descriptions of Quaker meeting. My mother's family was Quaker, but I grew up as a kind of normal. She didn't like the word atheist, so she said, you know, agnostic is a gentler word. But I remember actually bursting into tears when I was taught in a class that there were three classes of human beings: plants, animals, and humans. And it was part of a religious kind of explanation. I thought it's terribly wrong. But I guess I got my atheism out of my system. And at some point, what happened was my wife and daughter went to a Quaker meeting near where we live in Maine and came back saying, and Quaker meetings are totally unprogrammed. You don't have to do anything. It's silent, and somebody may or may not stand and say something. And somebody stood and said this sort of fragmentary, beautiful thing about standing in a creek looking at two rocks side by side and how the water moved over them. And they said, you know, and this, it was just so beautiful. And I thought, that you can do, even though I'd gone to a Quaker college, Haverford College, I'd never had any experience of that. And so I started to go to Quaker meeting, and I have learned so much from it. And I think it's in a small way made me a more thoughtful human being, even though I'm still not a believer in some sort of godlike personage. I do believe in a kind of truth to altruism and to trying to sit with a bunch of people and be your best self silently. Mm. And that there's something to this idea of expectant waiting and of somebody being forced, kind of pushed to stand and say something called testimony. Mm. And that moment of giving voice to something that is a sort of a collaborative act, that there's something to that that sums up what we're trying to do as people. We're trying to be decent to each other most of the time, and that's part of what a religion, even as religion is as unprogrammed and sometimes chaotic as Quakerism, ancient as Quakerism, has to offer.
But that sounds like an artistic urge to sit in silence and wait for something to come and then to voice it or express it.
Well, of course it does. It is artistic, and religions have stained glass and all kinds of things that they pull in, but it isn't at the time what it feels like is something better than art, more selfless or a little bit humbler than art. Mm-hmm. You're saying, I am nobody. I'm just a person in this room, and somebody else is going to stand and say something, and everyone else is going to think about it, and maybe that's the only thing said. And then everyone's going to stop at the end of the hour and shake hands and go away. And it's just, it's a powerful, and I think it has to be said, it's a religious experience, even if you, as I don't believe in, you know, a guy with a white beard sitting on a throne.
I like you.
Yes.
You are actually sitting on a throne right now.
Thank God.
So thank you very much, everyone, for coming, and please thank these three wonderful writers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was